So maybe I'll start by telling you why am I giving this talk in this time. So actually I was invited to go to some conference in Lumini and I didn't want to go. And then I had the idea of giving this talk and that gave me motivation and I decided to go anyway. And then later I got even better motivation along with Louis and Finton and Eva came up with the idea of the talk, which is on the other side of your handout, the 18 conjectures talk. And then I decided I'd give the 18 conjectures talk and put this handout that I'm showing right now and that you're holding on the back side so that people will ask me about it and I'll have conversation over lunch with them about it. Then everything collapsed and there was an ash cloud over Iceland or something and I didn't go to that conference at all and I still have two talks ready, prepared, and that I wanted to give. Joel, there is a handout over there. So the first one I ended up giving a week later in Göttingen and I videotaped it and I sent the tape to everyone, or rather the URL to everybody that was in Lumini. And I'm giving this talk now partially so as to have the videotape so I can send it to the few people that I really wanted to talk to in Lumini about this. So they will be receiving an email in a day or two with this videotape in it, on it. URL for it. Anyway, so this said, let me tell you what the talk is about. So, well, I will define something called W-naughts. I will tell you what a universal finite type invariant is. I will tell you that it's relatively easy to compute a universal finite type invariant, in fact, the universal finite type invariant for W-naught. And, not to compute, to show that it exists. And then it is somewhat hard to actually compute the answer. When you compute the answer, you get a certain determinant formula for it. This determinant formula, 100% minus epsilon, gives the a formula for the Alexander polynomial, but I actually don't have a proof that I can live with happily yet. But be it the Alexander polynomial or not, so, you know, 99.9% yes and 0.01% not. Be it either way, the results are interesting for reasons I will explain at the end. Anyway, so I have to start with W-naughts. So W-naughts are about two-dimensional knots in R4. Okay? A two-dimensional knot in R4 can be viewed as a movie of circles in R3. Okay? So here is one such movie which represents a part of a knot, and here is another such movie which represents a different type of part of a four-dimensional of a two-dimensional knot in R4. So before going through the formal definitions, I want to highlight a few, I want to explain what this is, okay? So one movie, it's called the real crossing or the honest crossing, represents two rings flying in R3 exchanging places, but they exchange places by one of them going through the other. Okay? And my convention is to project it to the plane and denote the bigger one as the upper one. Okay? So the notation upper over lower really means small flying through big. Okay? And of course this is not symmetric, because it's not the same. Well, this one flying through that one is not the same as the other way, as the other way around. Okay? And then there is another type of crossing, so another type of two-dimensional projection. And this is the movie, it corresponds to the movie in which the two rings trade places just by trading places. But we're in R4. This is what ordinarily makes knot theory. However, in R4, all ways of trading places are equivalent. All external ways of trading places are equivalent. So trading places this way, or that way, or that way, or that way are all equivalent, because there is a circle worth space of trading places, and the circle is connected. Okay, basically the circle is the angle between, or the vector between the two knots, as the two rings, as they trade places. Okay? So therefore, in the two-dimensional notation, I do not specify an over or an under. Okay? There is an alternative notation by drawing stuff in R3, or projecting from R4 to R3, and when you draw it in R3, you place cuts in the tubes that you see in the places where they are below other tubes in R4. Okay? So this picture actually corresponds to this picture, and this one corresponds to that one. And there is another way of drawing it, and I will mention it in a minute. There is also a formal definition, okay? But I don't want to go through it, because in fact, I have nothing to do with it, okay? But I do want to, I just want to emphasize that some formal definition exists, okay? And I do want to tell you though, that about the other way of viewing it, okay? So here's the other way of viewing it. Well, you represent a tube in R4 by a ribbon. Now, if you want to regenerate the tube from the ribbon, what you do is you think of the ribbon as being made out of two parallel membranes, and you push one of the membranes up in R4 and another one down in R4. So in cross-section, you start from a thing like this, and you, if this is the fourth coordinate, you it becomes a thing like that, which is a tube, okay? And so this will represent a legitimate knot in R4, because, so I guess I'm thinking of the one going through as being a bit narrower, and then when you push it, it pushes less far, and so it doesn't intersect the push out version of this band. So, you know, of this ribbon. So a different way of drawing these things is by drawing ribbons that are allowed to have this kind of intersection. Okay? But they're not allowed to have this kind of intersection, because you can think using, you know, you can figure out using the intermediate value theorem that somewhere along this dashed line there will be an intersection between the push out of this and the push out of that. Now, this represents a legitimate tube in R4. And as a tube in R4, it's equivalent to that one. As a ribbon knot in R3, it is not equivalent. These two are not equivalent. But in R4, they are equivalent. There are other relations that these pictures satisfy. First of all, they satisfy the so-called, you know what, maybe I'll go to the next slide. they satisfy the virtual Rademeister moves. So they satisfy the Rademeister moves for the crossings whose orientation is not specified. In other words, for the crossings in which two things trade places externally. And this is kind of obvious. Okay, no need to say anything. They also satisfy, so they satisfy this move. They also satisfy, and it's rather easy to show, the so-called detour move, in which two virtual crossings move to the other side of a single honest crossing. And again, an honest crossing represents the dishonest operation of one going through the other. Okay? They satisfy the standard Rademeister moves for the honest crossings. So if you have three rings of three different sizes, and I suppose I need Andrew to hold the biggest, okay, then they can trade places, the first two can trade places and then go through the bigger one, or alternatively they can both go through the bigger one and then trade places, and topologically it's equivalent. Okay? They also satisfy the overcrossings commute relation, which is shown over here and also over there. And perhaps the overcrossings commute relation can be is better explained in this picture, in this way of visualizing. And well, you look at it and it's obviously satisfied. Okay. Alternatively, if you want to see it using flying rings, the picture will be, again, I need Andrew. So you have one big ring and two small ones, and the two small ones may trade places externally and then go through the big, or they may go through the big and then trade places externally, and clearly the two ways of doing it are equivalent in R4. However, why is it called overcrossings commute? Because, if you mark the left strand here, X, and the right one, Y, so this is X, this is Y, likewise, this is X, this is Y, then from the perspective of the third one, we're going over X, then over Y, and over here we're going over Y and then over X. So over X over Y is the same as over Y over X, hence overcrossings commute. However, the opposite, which is drawn over here, or with the other notation drawn over here and called undercrossings commute, is not satisfied. And you can visualize, you can see it using this picture, right? If you try to push the small one up through the to the other side of the virtual crossing of the two big ones, it comes out twisted. So this one is not satisfied. And again, you can also do it with the Andrew method. So you take the two big rings. No, now you have to hold two. Okay? And for the small one to go through the first and then through the second is not the same as to go through the second and then through the first. In fact, if you contract the tiny one to a point, you get different elements of the fundamental group of the complement of these two. So these are W nodes. Now, if you want a formal definition, here is a formal definition. W nodes are, or if you want a combinatorial definition, here is a combinatorial definition. So W-nodes are the planar algebra generated by two types of crossings, okay? A virtual crossing and an honest crossing, modulo all the relations that I specified, that I mentioned before, okay? The word planar algebra means that you just are allowed to multiply these things whichever way you want in the plane. Okay? So you can put one of these crossings in the plane, and then another one of those crossings in the plane, and then another one again in the plane, and you can just assemble them in the plane in whichever way you want. Formal definitions exist, but they're not relevant right now. Okay? Alternatively, it's the circuit algebra generated by a single type of crossings, modulo only the relations that involve that single type of crossing, so the real crossing. So the Riedemeister 2 and 3 relation and the overcrossings commute relation, which I view as saying over x over y is equal to over y over x. So it involves only the over type of relation. Now, what's a circuit algebra? You should be thinking of circuit algebras like you're thinking of electric circuits. Okay? So an electric circuit can be made by taking electrical components, these are NAND gates, I suppose, and connecting them abstractly, not necessarily in the plane. So, you know, if you want to construct a flip-flop, you take two NAND gates and you connect them as follows. Well, there are outputs. I guess there is another type of component that you need, which is the trivalent junction. And then you connect the components as follows. Okay? Now, this crossing electrically means nothing. Okay? No connection is being made here. So in fact, and when you draw a picture like this, well, in reality, when you implement this circuit, you're going to implement it in some specific way. But logically, it really doesn't matter how this line goes to here. All that matters is that it connects from here to here. Electrically, all that matters is that this connects this point to that point, and you could have drawn the connection as I did, or equally well, you could have drawn it like that. Okay? So the circuit algebra generated by a single type of crossing would mean that you take that single type of crossing, you take several instances of it, and then you connect the ends as if it was an electric circuit in which this was a component. So you connect them whichever way you want, not in the plane, not in R18. I really don't care how they connect. I only care about the logic of the connections, not how they're made. Okay? And then you mod out by saying that if you have, three components organized in this way, then it's equivalent to those three components being organized in that way. That's Riedemeister 3. Okay? But of course, equally well, I could have written the left as this and the right as that. The relation still makes sense as a relation between components in an electric circuit. Okay? So, W-naughts are the circuit algebra generated by a crossing with the usual relation of knot theory plus an additional relation called overcrossings commute. Okay? Now, in fact, you know, there is a little bit of Riedemeister theory that has to be done here. Okay, in ordinary knot theory, there is a Riedemeister theorem, and it's a non-trivial theorem that says that the planar diagrams really do correspond to the topology. So a theorem like that has to be proven here. It was done by Blake Winter not so long ago. I think I'm skipping a tiny bit of the details. But morally this is right, okay? And I should say that he did it only in the case where you have a single component and when you're not allowing trivalent vertices, and when you're not allowing all sorts of things that later on in the theory we need. So you know, if you wish, later on in the theory, and I'm not going to talk about these parts of the theory today, you'll just have to stick to the combinatorial description and wait for the day that Winter or somebody else will complete the correspondence between the combinatorics and the topology. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
So if you were doing virtual nuts, is that you would also have what was the difference? You would have this undercrossing thing?
No, the opposite. Virtual nuts are W nuts without the overcrossings commute relation. You will disallow OC as well. Okay?
And what does that correspond to,
Well, you know, it corresponds to knots on drawn on surfaces, modulo addition and removal of handles. I'm not sure I like the picture.
So there's no relationship between this topological factor, or maybe no relationship. It's not obviously related to this, the fact that this is related to surfaces in R4.
Well, the virtual knots map into W knots because, well, W knots are a quotient of virtual knots. So whenever you have a virtual knot, it also represents a surface in R4, but it's a lossy transformation. Okay? And I don't know of a truly good topological picture for virtual knots. But that's a different story. That's not what I'm talking about now. Okay?
And so, when you study these W nuts, are you motivated by that topological picture of surface in R4, or are you just more motivated by this combinatorial planar algebra?
Well, maybe I should have explained what W stands for. It stands for several things. One is that it's weakly virtual. And there are several other things that it stands for. One other, the thing I like the most is that it's warm up. So I really care about virtual knots. Okay, and this is just a warm up for studying virtual knots. Now you can ask why I care about virtual knots. Is that sort of a different story? It's besides the point of today. You know what, I will at the end come back to it in some way. The part of the story that connects to today, I mean the story is much bigger, okay? But the part that connects to what I'm going to say today is the following. You know, there are ordinary knots map into virtual knots. So ordinary knots map into virtual knots, and virtual knots project into W knots. And you know, this looks very much like an exact sequence, but it isn't. Okay, the composition is not zero, it's just a pair of maps. Okay? I will show you today that the universal invariant or the universal finite type invariant of W knots is probably, most likely, the Alexander polynomial. So the universal invariant here is somehow the Alexander polynomial. If you never knew about the Alexander polynomial for U knots, you will have discovered it canonically when you study W knots. Okay, canonically as the solution of a very simple problem. Okay? Probably some people here already know of the Alexander polynomial, so they're not too impressed. Okay? However, you can ask about the universal invariant here. And the universal invariant here will be something bigger. And when you and if you want, you can compose it with the inclusion of U knots into W knots, and you'll get a bigger invariant of U knots. you can ask, okay, so what do you do with it? Well, it turns out that that invariant that you get is probably the Kontsievich integral, okay? So again, it's no news in some sense. However, just like W naughts are a quotient of V naughts in which the result is computable, the Kontsievich integral is somehow not very computable. So in a similar manner, there are many other quotients of V naughts. So there are other quotients by other relations, okay, which should make this invariant computable. And I really mean strongly computable in polynomial time. Okay? So, you know, from this narrow perspective, the reason to care is because if you push what I will tell you today a little further, it's likely that you will end up getting new polynomial time computable invariants of U naughts. Now, polynomial time computable is a big deal. Okay, it means you can actually compute it as opposed to just talk about it. So that's one way to motivate it. And this will not be the Alexander polynomial. The Alexander polynomial is already taken beyond.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
So I remember reading about this movies and movie moves of Carter and Psycho and
yes.
somebody else, and which is a description, a kind of combinatorial description for nonce and a four like this. And but it seems somehow much more complicated than this.
Yes, because I'm restricting my attention to ribbon knots in R4. So to knots in which the tube always bounds a disk, always bounds a handle body, in which only a certain type of singularities are allowed. Okay, so this is a limited part of this Carter-Saito theory. Okay. So, well, you know, oops, sorry. Oh, I guess I should have shown this. So, you know, so far I was showing only pieces. Here is a sort of the global picture. So if you have a picture like this, okay, so you have a knot, except one of the crossings is not specified as over or under, well, it becomes a tube in R4 in which looks like this. Okay. Anyway, going back to here, I said that the invariant is somehow a canonical one, and I have to explain in what sense. Okay. So I have to start with the finite type, the story of finite type invariants, and I'm assuming most people here have seen it, so I'll go through it rather quickly. The point is, given any invariant of knots, if you have any invariant whatsoever of knots, you can extend it to an invariant of knots with a double point by declaring that the double point is to be replaced either by an overcrossing or by an undercrossing with a minus sign. And then if you have a knot with several double points, so if you had a knot with several double points, these are double points, they're not the same as the things that appear in here, there is a bullet around it, okay? If you have several double points, you'll just resolve each one independently. And if you had, I don't know, three of them, you'll get 2^3 resolutions. So you'll get 8 honest knots. Each one will come with a sign, the sign being the product of the signs that are associated with each local resolution. Okay, And if you had an invariant of honest knots, so if you had some invariant V of honest knots, go with values, say, in the rationals, you'd compose it with this, and you found an invariant of knots with double points. Okay? The point is that differences, so a double point corresponds to a difference between an over and an under. Differences are more or less like derivatives. So you should be thinking of evaluating the original invariant V on a knot with several double points as if you are evaluating the nth derivative of the original invariant. Okay? So it's derivative on the space of knots somehow. Okay? And then a finite type invariant is like a polynomial on the space of knots. So do not confuse with a knot polynomial. It's not an invariant with values in polynomials. It's a numerical invariant whose behavior as a function on the space of all knots is like a polynomial. So an invariant is a polynomial of degree 7 if it vanishes, if its eighth derivative is equal to 0. In other words, if it vanishes whenever you extend it to knots with 8 double points. Okay, so this is classical. This is the story of ordinary knots. And it makes sense just the same, with some minor variations, in the case of W knots. So in the case of W knots, you define the semi-virtual crossing. So it's this purplish thing over here. So it's drawn like a crossing with a circle around it. You just define it to be the difference between an overcrossing and a no crossing. Okay? And then, and of course, there is likewise a semi-virtual undercrossing, which it's clear what it means. Okay? And then you say that an invariant V is of type M if its M plus first and higher derivatives vanish. In other words, if whenever you evaluate V on a knot that has in it more than M double points, or more precisely, semi-virtual crossings, you get zero. And finally, you call Vm the set of all type M invariants. Okay? So what I want is to study all finite type invariants. So the set of all Vms for all M. Okay? Now, sorry about that. Now, so again, I want to study, there used to be a pointer here somewhere. No, I guess I can make one. No, sorry. So, I want to study all these Vms, so I'll do it by induction. Since Vm contains Vm minus 1, right, a polynomial of degree m is also a polynomial of degree m minus 1, I'll assume that I've already studied Vm minus 1 yesterday and only studied the quotient of Vm modulo Vm minus 1. So I want to study the direct sum of all Vms. Sorry, of all Vm modulo Vm minus 1s. That's what it means to study by induction. Okay? Now, Vm pairs with what I will call I to the m. So let I to the m be let I to the M be the set of all knots, or W knots, in which in addition to the regular crossings, you also have exactly M semi-virtuals. Okay, so this is I to the M. Okay, and there is a reason for the name, but let's ignore it for now. okay? Then clearly, VM pairs with I to the M, right? Well, I to the M is a collection, or sorry, I want to say it differently. It's really the I to the M is the set of all resolutions of things like that. So you start from a picture in which you have M double points, okay, or M semi-virtuals. You replace each semi-virtual by a difference as written over there. So you get an alternating sum of 2 to the M ordinary W naughts. So in fact, I to the M is just a subset of the set of all virtual knots. Sorry, W knots. Okay? Now, Z's are invariants. Z's are knots. Obviously, they pair. Okay? They obviously pair. So you obviously have a pairing. Now, by definition, this pairing annihilates, on the right-hand side, it annihilates I to the M plus 1. Because the definition of an invariant of type M is that it vanishes on I to the M plus 1. So therefore, the pairing descends to this quotient. Also, by definition, invariants of type M minus 1 gets annihilated by I to the M. So the pairing descends to this quotient on the left. And furthermore, again, by definition, we've modded out by everything we could have modded out by. So therefore, there is a duality between this direct sum of Vm modulo Vm minus 1 with this direct sum of subspaces of Kw. Okay? The subspace of M cubes, the subspace of M cubes, so these are like M-dimensional cubes of W naughts taken with signs, modulo the subspace of M plus 1 cubes. And then again, take the direct sum over all M's, and you get this space. Now, I wanted to study this space, but since it's dual to that one, it's equivalent to studying this one. Okay? Now, I claim that, well, let me try to find a presentation for this space, okay? So, I'm going to show you that there is a certain space D of so-called arrow diagrams. So D is itself a direct sum of subspaces in which you have precisely M arrows, okay? And so I'm going to show you that there is a surjective map from a certain space of arrow diagrams into this space. And then I'm going to show you that there are some relations that are in the kernel of this surjection. And so it is reasonable to conjecture that this space is isomorphic to the space of arrow diagrams modulo these relations. So it's reasonable to conjecture that this space is isomorphic to the space of arrow diagrams modulo the relations. And then later I will show you the proof of this conjecture. Okay? So here are arrow diagrams. I don't need to say anything else, right? The picture shows an arrow diagram with 3 arrows, and it's completely clear what an arrow diagram with 17 arrows will be. Okay? Now, arrow diagrams map into this space by just declaring that you map an arrow to a semi-virtual crossing. So you just map an arrow between strand X and strand Y to, sorry, between part X of the long line here to part Y of the long line here. So, you know, really I should have drawn it this way. So an arrow going from X to Y is mapped into a semi-virtual crossing between X and Y. And I suppose the convention is that if X goes over Y, then the arrow tail starts at X. So it's this semi-virtual, okay? Which in itself is, by definition, this minus that, okay? So if you wanted to know where would this arrow diagram go, okay, you'll just map it to, well, you'll take three semi-virtuals, one, two, and three, and you'll connect them together as specified by the skeleton over here, okay? So I'm not showing it, but it's clear that it can be done. Furthermore, this is clearly surjective. Okay, clearly every knot that has exactly m semi-virtuals in it is obtained as the image of this knot. Okay? So you have arrow diagrams mapping into here, and let's figure out what the kernel is. The kernel, well, there are two types of elements in the kernel. But the whole problem is that there might be more, okay? But here are the two that I can find right away, okay? So first of all, you have the overcrossings commute relation. The overcrossings commute relation says that if these two crossings were real, then, and likewise these two crossings were real, then the left-hand side is equal to the right-hand side. But you see, if either one of these crossings is virtual, the left-hand side is, so if this one is virtual, it's the same as if this one was virtual here. So this is also true for semi-virtual crossings. So, but in the picture of semi-virtual crossings, it becomes the so-called, or converted to this language, it becomes the tails commute relation. So if you have two arrows, like here, and their tails are next to each other, then you can commute them. So, you know, back to this picture, you could commute these two arrows, and their image here would be the same. You could commute these two arrow tails, and the image here would be the same. Okay? So that's the easy relation, it's the tails commute relation. There is also the third 4T arrow relation. Let me just short it for 4T for today. Okay? So it goes like that. So consider a real lasso going over a semi-virtual crossing. Well, you could pull this lasso out because, first of all, well, if this semi-virtual crossing was replaced by a virtual crossing, then you could pull it because of overcrossings commute, because these are all over, so they commute with anything, you can just slide it out. And if this crossing is replaced, if the semi-virtual here is replaced by a real crossing, you could pull the lasso out simply because it's a Rademeister 3. It's a Rademeister 3 move, okay? So the picture shown here is equivalent to pulling the lasso out. Likewise here, where the lasso is involved with only virtual crossings. Virtual crossings don't exist, so I mean the lasso here is out already, okay? So this is equal to this. On the other hand, you could have gotten from here to here, by flipping this crossing, or rather by virtualizing this crossing, so by disappearing this crossing, turning it into virtual, and then turning this one into virtual, and then turning this one into virtual, and then turning this one into virtual. So the sum of four flips of a crossing to a virtual crossing is equal to zero. But that amounts to saying that the sum of four arrow diagrams is equal to zero. Taken with signs, it becomes the difference of two arrow diagrams is equal to the difference of some other two arrow diagrams. And here is how it is conventionally written. So blue corresponds to different parts of the skeleton. And basically, the statement is that if you have a fixed purple arrow, so this is the one here. It goes from here to here, from here to here, from here to here, from here to here. It's always the same. And you have another arrow head. Then the difference of commuting the arrowhead with the arrowhead of the fixed one is equal to commuting the arrowhead with the arrow tail of the fixed one. Okay, so that's the other relation, and it follows from this one immediately. Okay. Unfortunately, we still don't know that this is all. Okay. So right now, we know that the quotient of d by r maps into the space we care about. Okay? So we have a map tau going from d mod r into this space. We don't know yet. Well, we know that it is surjective, but we don't know yet that it is injective. Okay? How would I show that it is injective? So here is a way to do it. So this is a graded space, and this is a graded space. Now, the space WK, which I suppose I sometimes call K up W, sorry for the inconsistency in conventions. So this space of W naughts is filtered. It is filtered by, well, the filtration is exactly I to the m. So the mth degree of the filtration is I to the m, and it's a decreasing filtration. And in fact, what I wrote over here is precisely the associated graded of WK. Suppose you could find a filtered map from WK to d mod r, to A. Okay, suppose you had a filtered map Z going from here to here. Well, a graded space is in itself filtered. Okay? So it makes sense to look for such a filtered map. Well, if you have a filtered map like that, its associated graded would be a map from the associated graded of WK to the associated graded of A. But the associated graded of a graded space is itself. So GR of Z would be a map from the space we care about to A. If we could find a Z so that GR of Z composed with tau is the identity, then we're done. Okay? That proves that, well, tau was already surjective. This proves that tau is also injective, and so it's an isomorphism, and we've understood virtual knots, sorry, W knots. Or we've understood finite type invariant of W knots. Furthermore, we've constructed a universal invariant of W knots. Okay, we've constructed an invariant with values in A, and every other invariant is the evaluation of this invariant, is the composition of Z with a linear functional on A. This is this duality that I mentioned before. Okay? So our next challenge is to construct Z. We need to construct a map from W, from WK into A. Okay? So this turns out to be easier than you might think. So I wonder what I should do. So my plan was to go for as long as necessary. I don't know if your plan is to listen for as long as necessary. So should I, this would be the normal stopping time. Should I stop now and continue after 5 minutes, or just continue? What? 5 minutes. So let's take a 5 minutes break and then continue.